The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Anna Kogal from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the online Glamour magazines and what am I reading to you? Oh, I think it's Teen Vogue. Yeah, Teen Vogue. Well, welcome back, everyone. Hope you've had a great week. We've got a bunch of articles I'm going to be reading to you today, just varied in style and content. And the first one, you may be starting maybe to think about summer jobs, or maybe after you've graduated, or maybe just leaving your current job and going on to the next one. Well, here is an article from Glamour magazine. It's entitled, "Hiring Bots Are a Thing. This is How to Beat Them." Here's a fact. When you're job hunting, human beings aren't always looking at your resume. Experts used to say recruiters spend 6 seconds reviewing your resume before tossing it in the trash. Grab their attention fast. But forget that idea. Computers have been doing the gatekeeping for years, screening for keywords and employment gaps. Now tech is taking things to the next level. Much the way Netflix suggests Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt after you watch 1:30 Rock. Companies are starting to use artificial intelligence, AI, and sophisticated tests, in addition to algorithms, to not only find candidates for a job, but also predict who will kick ass at it. The hope is that these tools will reduce costly turnover and, most important, help fix the human error and bias that have historically shut out women and minorities. Great goal. But how will all this work? After gathering company data, these systems would be trained in ways that reflect ideas of quote-unquote successful and quote-unquote unsuccessful at a given company, says Meredith Whitaker, co-founder of AI Now, a research institute at New York University that studies the social effects of AI. But if a company isn't diverse, especially in executive and leadership roles, the software would likely replicate existing biases that see certain people, often white men, as inherently more capable and successful than others. In other words, version 2.0 of the hiring bots may be an improvement, or maybe not. But they're coming. So here's how to work them to your advantage. Get past the first gatekeeper. At least 98% of Fortune 500 companies use an automated applicant tracking system, ATS, or resume screener, according to JobScan, a tech company that helps applicants improve their resume to beat the machines. ATS software is designed to assess an applicant based on keywords, says Amanda Augustine, a career advice expert at Top Resume, a New York City resume writing company. Without the right ones, she warns, your resume may never get past this initial digital gatekeeper. A simple hack. Pick out the important keywords located in the job listing and incorporate them in your skills and work experience sections, Augustine says. Not sure which are the most important ones? You can make a word cloud out of a job description using a free tool like Wordle, W-O-R-D-L-E, she suggests. For women in particular, certain parts of a resume may hinder their chances of getting past an ATS. A key issue is gaps in employment, says Ifeoma Ajunwa, PhD, an assistant professor of organizational behavior at Cornell University. Some algorithms, Ajunwa explains, might be trained to reject resumes with gaps, which could mean that women who take time off to raise children may want to explicitly list that, or some other part-time activity on their resume rather than leave those years blank. Augustine says to consider proper formatting, too, because complicated design elements can get lost on the software. Stick to a simple design that doesn't include embedded charts, images, or unusual fonts. Make the predictive algorithm predict you. Companies are also moving past traditional hiring assessments, like personality tests, which experts say don't accurately predict your job success, and are instead using AI, algorithms, and neuroscience games to better match your abilities to a role. Frieda Pauli, P-O-L-L-I, Ph.D., created Pymetrics, an AI-based recruiting platform to fix the hiring process after seeing her fellow Harvard Business School classmates struggle to find the right jobs. I was amazed to see how many people put a lot of time and effort into getting recruited into a new field and then were not happy when they actually started working in it. If they had gotten a better understanding of their fit for that role, she says, some of that pain for workers and companies may have been prevented. Pauli says Pymetrics uses algorithms to predict whether someone's skills line up with a particular job by comparing their answers with those given by a company's top performers. Platforms like Pymetrics also say their software can also decrease hiring biases, such as discriminating against resumes with female or non-white sounding names, by focusing on selected traits that social science research says are largely free of gender and racial bias, like risk tolerance and planning style. If a hiring manager puts the most emphasis on hiring from a resume, women and people of color have a reduced chance of getting the job, Pauli says. The method appears to be working, at least for some companies. While Pymetrics doesn't disclose client names for privacy reasons, it has reported impressive gains in 2018 hiring, an 18% increase in female technical hires, and a 20% increase in minority interns at one financial service company. But some industry professionals are wary. A lot of algorithmic hiring tools use data from an employer's existing network or what's available on the internet, says Stephanie Lampkin, CEO and founder of Blendor, D-O-O-R, whose hiring technology aims to reduce unconscious bias by hiding data like names and ages. If you rely solely on limited information, you're not accessing underrepresented talent. If you're asked to take this kind of assessment during your job search, Augustine recommends you do a little sleuthing. Check sites like Glassdoor to find out if a prospective employer is known for using this kind of technology as part of their candidate evaluation process, she says. If you know anyone who works at the company or has interviewed with this employer in the past, reach out to see if they can shed any light on the interview process. Augustine adds that applicants can also visit a tool's website to get a better feel for how it's used. Your mood while taking these tests is also key, says Tomas Chamorro Premovic, Ph.D., a professor of business psychology at University College London and Columbia University. If you can, he says, take the assessments in a calm moment when you're awake but not overly aroused. Translation, coffee, but not too much coffee. Or skip the bots altogether. Eventually, you'll need to win over a person in real life to get a job. In this ever-evolving hiring world, you have to make networking a priority. Studies have shown that you are 10 times more likely to land the job when your application is accompanied by an employee referral. Augustine says. Those real-life connections are key, she says. If you can, get someone to pass your resume along to the hiring manager, thus bypassing the initial application gatekeepers, you're more likely to get the interview, and you're one step closer to your dream job. All right, and here's another one from Glamour. This one is entitled, The Pink Tax on Your Student Loans. In 2016, 56% of undergraduate students nationwide were female. Women had heard the call to excel, enroll. But with record matriculation rates has come something else, record debt. Women are now responsible for two-thirds of student loan debt in the United States, according to the American Association of University Women. By next year, the amount women will need to pay back is estimated to total $1 trillion, with the average female borrower owing around $21,000 after graduation. That's a colossal sum, and it's roughly $2,700 more than her average male counterpart owes, according to the AAUW. That's the American Association of University Women. What gives? For one, the wage gap. Women tend to earn less for their work even before school, which means they need more money than men do to finance higher education. And in the post-grad workforce, the pay gap also means it takes women longer to pay off loans. Degree in hand, women make 26% less than men on average. Black and Hispanic women, who make less on a dollar than white women, fall further behind. Exploitative recruitment tactics put some women at even greater risk. The for-profit Vatterott College targeted, quote, welfare mom with kids, end quote, pregnant ladies, quote unquote, and dead-end jobs, no future, quote unquote, according to a 2012 Senate HELP Help Committee report. Even reputable for-profit institutions or for-profit institutions can cost as much as 40% more than non-profit public institutions, says Jennifer Wang, director of the Washington, D.C. Office of the Institute for College Access and Success, and can leave students saddled with not just debt, but credentials that aren't as valuable in the labor market. If you're picking up some class or going back for a degree and are concerned about cost and quality, Wang recommends you look into community colleges and four-year public colleges. There is no quick fix to the wage gap, and better policies could take years to pass. The House of Representatives is considering the PROSPER Act, PROSPER, which would actually reduce financial aid for students who need it most. But experts say there is one great option on the books now. For anyone with student debt, income-based repayment plans available for both new and existing loans. These allow borrowers to delay payments until their income rises above a certain amount. Once their wages go up, payments are capped at a percentage of their salary. And if the balance isn't paid off in 20 to 25 years, most plans offer loan forgiveness. Income contingent repayment is the direction of the future, says Judith Scott Clayton, an associate professor of economics and education at Teachers College, Columbia University. But a lot of people don't know about these plans. They can involve logistical and paperwork challenges, but the trouble is worth it, she says. This is absolutely a PSA to get yours. Okay, I've got one more from Glamour, and then we'll go on to Teen Vogue. This is How Tinder Killed the Crush. It's just a little crush. It's hard to get butterflies about someone who's just a two-dimensional face in your screen. And this is by Dana Schwartz, February 12, 2019. Your first crush is a rite of passage. The fixations that follow it are just life. Nervous, awkward, sublime, disastrous, transcendent. Here, we celebrate infatuations, obsessions, and passions in all their exquisite splendor. Meet our It's Just a Little Crush series. Isn't she divine? I've decided to delete Tinder from my phone again. Again. To do it, I have to hold down the icon of the app, then tap the little X to get it off my iPhone. Like all apps, the square does a little wiggle when the X pops up. The animation is more or less innocuous, but when it comes to Tinder, that little wiggle is a taunt. You'll be back, wiggle, wiggle. I won't stay gone for long, wiggle, wiggle. You'll get lonely and want to see if you can find someone who's, wiggle, wiggle, fluent in sarcasm, wiggle. For about 5 years, my relationship with Tinder has been more on and off than any of my several less than stable romantic relationships. But then, romantic relationships take discipline and commitment and time. The better metaphor for Tinder is addiction. Tinder is accessible when I'm at my lowest and gives me a temporary burst of dopamine and distraction, but never more. And like an addiction, it's robbed me of at least one of life's purest pleasures. A million people and articles can explain how Tinder has ruined courtship and even hookup culture. But its truest victim is the single element that makes flirtation fun. Tinder killed the crush. You might think that Tinder would be a crush paradise. After all, crushes are all about instinctual attraction. And what's more instinctual than evaluating someone's picture and swiping left or right based on your gut reaction, plus learning their 6'1", 6'1", INTJ, and from the looks of their picture, were once on a boat. Tinder should fulfill the smartphone promise, making things quicker and easier. I'm able to order a pizza and ride in a stranger's car at the touch of a button. When I'm lonely and bored, I should be able to materialize a crush, someone to joyfully obsess over with all the hope of someone who thinks she's found the one. But see, that smartphone modus operandi, speed, convenience, runs counter to how human connection works. Part of the problem is after swiping on Tinder for a few hours, let alone days or weeks, potential partners become almost interchangeable. To the shrewd, practiced swiper, a mere glance at a profile picture is enough to know whether that person merits a right or left swipe. Glasses, right. Dog, right. Fish, left. Mirror selfie, left. Red hat, left. Even when you're intrigued enough to click for more information on someone, everyone blurs together into a single, amorphous Jim looking for his Pam. Far from being fun, early getting to know each other conversations quickly become a chore. Our attraction to a person in the real world is based on their smell, the sound of their voice, the things they laugh at. On Tinder, people are just cardboard cutouts. Every time I succumb to it, I find myself using the same trite questions and getting the same trite answers. It's rare that I ever give someone my phone number to propel the conversation to text. It was even rarer to feel a connection so undeniable that it propelled us into the real world. It's hard to get butterflies about someone who's just a two-dimensional face in your screen. One of 25 guys saying, "Hey, how's your weekend looking?" Now, a crush. A crush is magnificent. Next to the we're comfortable enough to finally just wear pajamas and order in stage? It's the best part of a relationship when each text notification sends a shiver of excitement through your entire body and you post selfies to your Instagram story just to see if they'll see them. Yes, it's also a stage of paranoia. Who is that girl in that Facebook picture from 2011? And misery in the minutes waiting for the response to a risky text. But that exquisite pain just heightens the euphoria when he does text back, and when you find out that the girl from 2011 was actually just his sister all along. The one time I ever remember feeling something akin to a crush on someone I saw on an app, it was because I recognized him on Twitter. Without external context, he would have been completely inscrutable. In all likelihood, if I hadn't known he was hilarious and liked the same movies I did from his tweets, I would have swiped left. Although, in all fairness, maybe I should have. We went out for 3 months. Then he dumped me via text. Tinder is transactional and gamified. The swipe is a slot machine. It entices you to go for one more swipe, and then one more, just to see what else is out there. But no one can match up against the prospect of all other single people in the world, plus the ones who exist in your imagination. It's the same mentality that keeps people glued to the slots in Vegas casinos. The next swipe could be the jackpot. But perhaps the biggest problem with Tinder is also how it sold itself to us. You only match with people who you know are interested in you, or at least interested enough. The pleasure of the crush is in how it starts, the uncertainty of it. A crush is a challenge and a terrifying risk. The not knowing part, the time when you have no idea how the other person feels about you, is about 80% of the sensation we describe as butterflies. It's exhilarating, miserable, torturous, and ecstatic. The stuff of sending a flirty text that you outsourced to your entire group chat, that tension doesn't exist on Tinder, where you only end up in conversation with someone once you've established mutual attraction. That other person at least wants to meet up, if just to hook up. And that happens after you've waded through throngs of F-boys and randos. If you're looking to meet someone in real life but still want the expediency of the internet, I recommend a good old-fashioned Twitter DM slide. A little audacious? A little audacious. Full of anticipation. But same rule applies for bathroom mirror selfies. If that's their profile pic, metaphorically, swipe left. Okay, so now here's something fun from teenvogue.com. And this is, feeling hangry is real. If you've ever been super mad and hungry at the same time, science is about to validate you. A dietitian featured on a recent episode of BBC Radio's Woman's Hour said that hunger triggers a chemical response similar to anger for everyone. That's right, feeling hangry is real. As people's blood sugar drops due to irregular meals, their cortisol and adrenaline levels increase in the body, explained Sophie Medlin, a lecturer in nutrition and dietetics at King's College London. This physiological response triggers a fight or flight feeling in the brain that is similar to the chemical reaction for anger. The chemicals in our brain actually mirror each other for hunger and rage, creating what people have long recognized as hanger. The wonderful world of social media has merged the two words for us, and now we know it as anger, Medlin told BBC Radio. The chemicals in the brain that trigger for hunger are the same ones that trigger for anger and rage and impulsive type behaviors. So that's why you get that sort of same response. Now that we know anger is the real deal, don't let people convince you it's not a thing. Interestingly enough, people are much more likely to experience hungry irritability if they have higher levels of testosterone. Being hangry can lead to real-life relationship consequences, too. A 2014 study revealed that low blood glucose levels can lead to increased aggression between married couples. The easiest way to curb the hanger response? Indulge in a savory, carbohydrate-type snack, Medlin says. After all, it's better to take a bite out of food than friendship. All right, and I'm just going to quickly switch back to glamour and give you a recipe for sweet potato sage fritters. Peel and grate two large sweet potatoes. In a large bowl, combine sweet potatoes, 2 cups rice flour, 1 cup finely chopped yellow onion, 1/2 cup non-dairy milk, and 1/4 cup finely chopped sage. Use your hands to mix. In a large skillet over medium-high heat, heat 1 inch canola oil. Drop a small piece of sweet potato into oil. If it sizzles, the oil is hot enough. Use 3 tablespoons mixture. Form 1/2 inch thick discs. Carefully add to skillet and cook about 2 minutes per side until crisp and lightly browned. Cool on a paper towel-lined plate. Repeat with remaining mixture, adding more oil to skillet to maintain the 1 inch depth. Serve warm with store-bought pear or apple chutney and dairy-free sour cream. Yum! And I think that should help you not feel hangry, too. Well, we have run out of time for today's episode of Teen Magazines. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Anika Gal, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleradioreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Don't go around hangry. And by the way, write in that journal that we've been talking about a bit. What are your dreams? What are your aspirations? What are the things you love? What are your favorite things to eat so that you're not hangry? All right, take good care, and we'll see you next time.